Everybody by default.
Happy Hanukkah, everybody.
Happy Hanukkah. Made it under the gun before the muting. All right. First of all, thank you to everybody who signed up for the next series, the Jewish numerology series that we start next week. Thank you to Moish. That was your suggestion for the topic. Hopefully we will do it justice. I've been preparing it, and I'm having a lot of fun preparing it, that's for sure. We'll see how it goes. But I think it's going to be a good series. I'm going to put the link in the chat again for the source sheet, since people have just joined. Like I said originally, for this added session, we may need an hour, we may not need an hour. We'll see how it goes. But thank you very much for making the time to discuss the hope of Yoshiyahu, also known as Josiah. And we already learned about the period in between week 2 and week 3, so to speak. Meaning that in week 2, or which became week 3, we saw Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, and we saw his error, and how that led to the splitting of the kingdom between the north and the south. In the north, Yisrael, and in the south, Yehuda. We learned that the northern kingdom veers off very quickly into idolatry, whereas the southern kingdom is back and forth. We listed the kings of Judah after Rehoboam. I decided not to bring them again on the source sheet because there's an awful lot of material here already. But you did have it on last week's source sheet, and we saw how it was kind of up and down. Good king, bad king, couple of good kings, some bad kings, then some good kings, back and forth. And we get to Yoshiyahu, to Josiah, at a point where it's, according to historians, roughly 6th century before the Common Era. Within Jewish traditional chronology, it's 5th century before the Common Era. And the immediate predecessors of Yoshiyahu, of Josiah, have left him an absolute mess. In terms of the Judaism of the nation, in terms of the society itself, we learned about Menashe's reign in which blood is spilled in Jerusalem from end to end. Menashe repents but is not able to bring the nation back with him. Menashe's son Amon continues to be as bad as his father. His servants kill him, not necessarily because they're so righteous, but they just do. And they place Yoshiyahu, Josiah, as king at the age of 8. This session is dedicated by Zina Zobin. Thank you, Zina, for the yahrzeit of her father, Yaakov Moshe ben Yitzchak Tzvi HaKohen. You should benefit from our community's learning. So, Yoshiyahu starts off his career as a man of reform. He wants to change things. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 1, this is describing Josiah, Yoshiyahu, in the early days of his reign. He did what was pleasing to the Lord, and he followed all the ways of his ancestor David. He did not deviate to the right or to the left. This is a good one. We found a good king. Okay, I'm going to continue with the rest of that in a little bit. One note that I'm going to make now, I think I may have made it earlier in the series also, but it's an important note to understand. When you look at the books of the Bible, there's a temptation to assume that each period of history gets one book, right? We're familiar with the Pentateuch. You have the 5 books, and they proceed in a more or less linear progression. A little jumping here and there, but basically a linear progression. And then you get into Joshua after the Jews enter the land, and that gives way to the book of Samuel, and that takes us through the reign of King Saul and then King David. And then you move into the book of Kings. But at that point, once you get into the book of Kings, you have more than one track in the books of the Bible. You have one track that's being described in the book of Kings, and you have another track that's being described in what's called Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles. Chronicles starts earlier than the period of the kings. We find David already there. But Chronicles really gets underway in terms of giving us a lot of information that's missing in other books in the book of Kings. So when you read about what's going on in the time of Josiah, you have to keep track of the book of Kings, and you also have to keep track of the book of Chronicles. You follow? That's important to be aware of. It just means that you need to know more than one book. That's really what I'm trying to say in a very long-winded way. Sorry, Rosalind, you're muted. What?
Sorry, but are they written chronologically? Are they simultaneous events?
So they are written regarding the same events, but in very different times. The Book of Kings is recorded at the end of the First Temple period by the prophet Jeremiah. The Book of Chronicles is recorded by Ezra in the beginning of the Second Temple period. So much longer after the events took place, and with agenda. Jeremiah is a prophet. His mission is to get the people to follow God. So he is going to describe the flaws and the errors, and he is going to tell you this bad thing happened to them because they abandoned God. They should come back. He's going to play up the righteousness of the good ones. That's Jeremiah's job. However, Ezra's job is to bolster the monarchy of the house of David. He's writing the book of Chronicles in an attempt to instill confidence in a new generation of Jews fresh in from Babylon in their kings. So it's a very different goal. So for example, Rosalind, you had asked last time about David and the story with Bathsheba, and I told you we're not getting to that. But that story is omitted from David's stories in the book of Chronicles. Ezra has no interest in causing people to doubt David. That's not what he's trying to do. He's trying to give them confidence in their new reign, not to make them question its worth. So that's something you have to be aware of as you read it. Chronicles is a book that most people never get to. Sorry?
No, there's noise in the
background. Oh, okay. It starts with a lot of begats. A lot of the information is also seen elsewhere in Tanakh. And it's the end of Tanakh. So, you know, you have to get there, so to speak. And it's not exciting, by and large. So people often just skip it. But there is quite a bit to know about from it. I'm going to mute people by default because I'm getting background noise. So I stress this here because if you take a look at source number 2, we're going to jump into some Chronicles information. We already said that Josiah Yoshiyahu is following David from a young age, which also appears in Chronicles 2, chapter 34. And then you find out, source number 2 from Chronicles, in the 8th year of his reign, so he's 16 years old, while he was still young, he began to seek the God of his father David, and in the 12th year, so he's now 20, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the shrines, the sacred posts, the idols, and the molten images. These are translations, as you can see on my sheet from the JPS edition, but it's basically what I would have done, more or less. At his bidding, they demolished the altars of the Baals, and he had the incense stands above them cut down. Remember, Baal is the leading idolatrous franchise in the land at that time. It's a chain. There's Baal this place, Baal that place, Baal that place. So Baal itself is a fertility god. It's a male god. And he gets rid of the altars and the incense stands for it. He smashed the sacred posts, the idols, the images, ground them into dust, and strewed it onto the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. He is getting rid of idolatry. Jumping now back to the book of Kings 2, in source number 3, we get something fascinating. Actually, did I start it in the place I wanted to? No, I started a little bit too late. Bummer. Okay. Oh, I know why. Go back to source number 1. That's why. Source number 3 is fine, but I meant to take you back to source number 1. After we read there that he followed the ways of his ancestor David in that second sentence, in the 18th year of King Josiah, not his 18th year like he's 18 years old, but the 18th year of his reign, so he's now 26, the king sent the scribe Shaphan, son of Azaliah, son of Meshulam, to the house of the Lord, and he gave him a job. And the job he gave him was to refurbish the temple. Both Chronicles and Kings record this. There is some difference in terms of order of events that I didn't want to get distracted with about which thing happened at which stage in his reign. But what we have here is a picture of a king who says, the people have been misled by my predecessors, father and grandfather, Amon and Menashe. I want to go back to David's ways. Personally, I want to, and I want to get the nation to. So I'm getting rid of all the idols, and I want to restore the worship of God in the temple in Jerusalem. Clear? That's what he says. And that brings us to source number 3. Kings 2, chapter 22. The space between source number 1 and source number 3 just describes the mission of cleaning up the temple and reinforcing it. And then you get a remarkable event. Then the high priest Chilkiah, who, by the way, may be the father of Jeremiah. Jeremiah is Jeremiah, son of Chilkiah. So just to be aware of that. Then the high priest Chilkiah said to the scribe Shaphan, I have found a scroll of the teaching, Sefer HaTorah in the Hebrew, in the house of the Lord. I found the Torah. Now, you and I look at that and say, well, why not? Why wouldn't there be a Torah in the house of the Lord? But look at the reaction that the discovery gets. And Chilkiah gave the scroll to Shaphan, who read it. The scribe Shaphan then went to the king and reported to the king, your servants have melted down the silver that was deposited in the house. They have delivered it to the overseers of the work who are in charge of the house of the Lord. The scribe Shaphan also told the king, the high priest Chilkiah has given me a scroll. And Shaphan read it to the king. When the king heard the words of the scroll of the teaching, the Sefer HaTorah, he rent his clothes. And the king gave orders to the priest Chilkiah and to Achikam, son of Shaphan, Achbor, son of Michaiah, the scribe Shaphan, and Asaiah, the king's minister, go inquire of the Lord on my behalf and on behalf of the people and on behalf of all Judah concerning the words of this scroll that has been found. For great indeed must be the wrath of the Lord that has been kindled against us, because our fathers did not obey the words of this scroll to do all that has been prescribed for us. So, he hears this scroll and something upsets him. He tears his clothing. He says, God is angry. We need to find out what God wants of us. Something in this scroll upset him greatly. Clear? Got a message in the chat. The name Yoshiyahu can be confusing because there's also Yeshayahu. Yes, that is true. It can be confusing. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, we didn't use the entire alphabet when we named people. We used only a subset of the letters of the alphabet. Certain letters we really wanted. It wasn't like today where, you know, the World Health Organization is determined to teach us all the Greek alphabet. And we're going to get to Omicron. We just basically used Yud and Shin and Hey a lot. So, yes, the answer is it is a little bit confusing. In any case, Yoshiyahu, Josiah, says, we need to find out what God wants of us. And he sends his letter, his scroll, to a prophet. But here's something fascinating. At this time, towards the end of the first temple, the major prophet of the day is Jeremiah. But he doesn't send the scroll to Jeremiah. Take a look at the beginning of source number 5. So the priest Chilkiah and Achikam, Achbor, Shaphan, and Asaiah went to the prophetess Huldah, the wife of Shalum, son of Tikva, son of Harhaz, keeper of the wardrobe, who was living in Jerusalem in the area called the Mishneh, and they spoke to her. They go to Huldah instead of going to Jeremiah. And the Talmud is puzzled. Why didn't you go to the leading prophet of the day? I mean, he's the one who everybody knows. People really, generally speaking, don't know about Chulda today other than because of this story. So take a look at the Talmud's answer in source number 4. How could Josiah abandon Jeremiah and send for her? In the yeshiva of Rabbi Shila, they explained, because women are merciful. He wanted to get a good answer. He wanted to get a positive answer. He figures, if I go to a man, he's going to give me a hard time. I'm going to go to a woman who's a prophet, and hopefully she'll be a little bit more merciful. Unfortunately, it doesn't work out that way. But that's his thought. There's another answer. Hang on 1 second, Rose. In Rabbi Yochanan, in that same passage in source number 4, he says Jeremiah was out of town, bringing back the 10 tribes. We're going to have to talk about that one. Yes, Rose.
I don't understand. Wasn't it just a Sefer Torah?
Yes.
What was the Sefer Torah that was...
That's where we're going next. That's where we're going next. But first I want to show you Chulda's response. Source number 5. After we read about having sent to Chulda, the third line in source number 5. She, Chulda, responded, "Thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, say to the man who sent you to me, thus said the Lord, I am going to bring disaster upon this place and its inhabitants, in accordance with all the words of the scroll which the king of Judah has read. Because they have forsaken me and have made offerings to other gods and vexed me with all their deeds, my wrath is kindled against this place, and it shall not be quenched. But say this to the king of Judah, who sent you to inquire of the Lord. Thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, as for the words which you have heard, because your heart was softened and you humbled yourself before the Lord when you heard what I decreed against this place and its inhabitants, that it will all become a desolation and a curse, and because you rent your clothes and wept before me, I for my part have listened, declares the Lord. Assuredly I will gather you to your fathers, you will be laid in your tomb in peace, your eyes shall not see all the disaster which I will bring upon this place." So they brought back the reply to the king. Josiah, you're a good one. You will not have to see the destruction that's coming, but make no mistake, destruction is coming. Yes, Claudette.
Question. This is a prophetess that they went to.
Yes.
The Torah have many prophetess. And another point I would like to make, what is fascinating about Josiah is that how young and wise he was and how young Solomon was when they governed.
Yes. There's a line in the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, right, which says, don't look at the barrel or the jar or the bottle. Look at what's in it. Sometimes you have an old barrel. By the way, it's the opposite. Sometimes you have a new barrel that contains aged wine, and sometimes you have an aged barrel that doesn't even contain new wine. Age is important. Experience is important. But you can see, as you know, that Josiah had maturity beyond his years. That seems clear. So, going back to your first question, yes. The Talmud, in that same section from which I brought number 4, lists 7 women in Tanakh who had prophecy. Some of them are very famous, like Sarah. But they go through the different, the list of the 7 prophetesses. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. So they find this scroll while they're refurbishing the temple. Something in it really frightens Josiah. And as we just asked, what? It's just a scroll. Like, what's the big deal? So there are historians who claim that this was actually not a discovery. It was a plant. It was planted and not, was it, yeah, it was planted specifically in order to create shock value. It was newly created back then, and it was the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy did not exist until this moment in time, say some historians. What's their basis? The book of Deuteronomy has laws that focus on centralized worship in the temple, characteristic of the land of Israel, and characteristic of what Josiah was trying to accomplish. It has a lot of weighing in against idolatry and arguing for the removal of idolatry, it has certain commandments that don't appear in the rest of the Torah, and therefore they argue this is actually a new book. Some of the commandments are new, sometimes they seem to be different from what existed previously in the Torah. So they argue this is a new book in Josiah's time with a particular agenda. I find this view less than compelling. First of all, from a religious standpoint, I find it unacceptable. Meaning, I believe that the entire Torah that we have is the original. Whether that means that there's ever been a mistake in, you know, recording something, you know, there's a letter here, a letter there, that's not what I'm talking about. The five books are the five books. They were never the four books. There wasn't a moment in time when they were the Quadratuch, and then they became the Pentateuch, as far as I am concerned. And the proof of that is, if you pick up a Sansino, which is totally very, very old, older than Josiah, you will see it says Pentateuch on it. Now, that was a joke. But aside from my religious inability to accept such an idea, I just find it non-compelling because laws against idolatry are found throughout the Torah, as is construction and maintenance of a central site for communal worship. It's called the Mishkan, and it's there already in the book of Exodus. It is emphasized throughout the book of Leviticus. It's repeated again in the book of Numbers. Like, it's there throughout. That's number one. Number two, we have yet to find any ancient scroll that has Deuteronomy separate from the rest, or that has just the four books. It's not like there's anything around to support this in terms of evidence. And I don't know why somebody who encountered Deuteronomy for the first time would read those laws and be shocked. Like I said, those laws are there before. Laws against marrying into the Canaanites, laws against worshiping idols. They're not new in Deuteronomy. So I find this non-compelling, and like I said, religiously I can't accept it even if I didn't have these problems with it. So I'm not alone in not accepting that approach. Historically, Jewish commentary offered three answers that did not involve inventing a new book. Rashi's approach is, this is actually a Torah scroll. And it was unfamiliar because King Ahaz, earlier in the hierarchy of kings, King Ahaz was the father, grandfather, great-great-grandfather of Josiah. King Ahaz went on a campaign, which is described in Tanakh, to burn copies of the Torah. This Torah scroll was hidden, and it was unfamiliar to people because of that. Take a look at source number 6, Rashi's commentary to Kings 2. It was hidden beneath a pile of stones buried there when Ahaz burned the Torah. That's Rashi's answer. What's the difficulty with Rashi's answer? Why is that a hard answer to accept? Well, number one, it's a hard answer to accept because our story began with Josiah following God's ways from the age of, well, not from the age of 8, from the age of 16 or whatever it was, that he's walking in the ways of God. How did he do that if he didn't have a Torah? Right? If Torah is new to him here, what did he think the ways of God were? That's problem number one. Problem number two, and Radak points this out, is that if you were to look back at last week's source sheet and the list of kings, you would see that after King Ahaz, you had King Chizkiyahu, who was incredibly righteous. You can't tell me he didn't have a Torah scroll. It just doesn't work. And if you'll tell me about King Menashe, who came after Chizkiyahu, Menashe repented at the end of his life. Well, maybe it was still, you know, the Yoshio was still very young and he wasn't familiar. There are answers you can give. But that's one approach. A second approach is brought, if you remember, those of you who were in the Pensadores class, so we talked about Rabbi Yosef Albo. So Rabbi Albo, he was the last one we talked about in that series, he offers a different answer, which is taken up by others as well, including Rabbi David Altshuler in source number 7. And he says, it wasn't just any Torah scroll. It was Moses' Torah scroll. If you take a look at source number 8, before we jump back to number 7, from Deuteronomy itself. And when Moses finished writing the words of this Torah upon a scroll until their completion, and Moshe instructed the Levites, bearers of the Ark of the Covenant of God, take the scroll of this Torah and place it beside the Ark of the Covenant of Hashem, your God. It will be a testimony for you there. It wasn't just any Torah. It was Moses' handwritten copy of the Torah. Yes, Ruchama.
Yeah, that's why it's called Mishneh Torah.
It's called Mishneh Torah because it's a summary of what appears earlier in the Torah. Yes. So this is then Moses' record of the Torah, and it had been hidden. Take a look back now at number 7, where Rabbi Altshuler explains. The Kohanim feared that Achaz would send forth his hand against the Torah written by Moses from God that had been located beside the Ark. They took it and buried it, and after his death, they searched for it and did not find it. It was buried, and then nobody knew where it was until now as they're refurbishing the temple. There is a piece of scriptural evidence to support this in source number 9. The record of the discovered scroll in Chronicles 2. And when they brought out the silver which had been brought to the house of God, all the donations, Chilkiyahu the priest found the scroll of the Torah of God in the hand of Moses. So you could read that as the Torah that Moses conveyed from God to the people, not literally his handwriting. However, you can see that this lends itself to it. This text in Chronicles makes it sound like, no, it's in Moses' hand. He actually wrote it. So that's a second idea. First idea is it's a Torah scroll, and it was shocking because there weren't any around. Second idea is that it's Moses' handwriting, and he says, oh, wow. The weakness that I have with this answer is, why would it be cause for fear? Right? You find the scroll of Moses, you should be inspired, but not afraid. It's odd. Paul says, misread something in the chat. Sorry, Moish. You're muted, Moish.
There we go. Okay. When Achaz made that order about burning them,
yeah,
they came up with a solution of splitting a Sefer Torah into 5 scrolls. Because it would be more difficult to get rid of all of them if they were all split up in different places.
Really?
When Hezekiah came by, and he wanted to make things better, but he knew that his son was going to be a menace again. And he thought to himself, you know what? Let's keep it this way. Maybe they had a few that were whole, but they kept having these at the end of the Beis Hamikdash. They kept.
But why would you need such a theory? What's the benefit of such a theory?
The benefit is that it would be more difficult to
Village in 5 houses. No, but I understand what you're saying, but I don't understand what you gain by the theory. Like, and therefore what?
And then you could put together a complete Torah from 5 different villages.
No, that's not what I'm saying. There's nothing within the story itself to indicate that they found Deuteronomy. The reason the historians say it is because they just believe Deuteronomy is a late edition. And they locate it at this time because this is when there's a campaign to refurbish the temple. But it's not as though they see any evidence in the story itself to indicate that what was found was due to
wrong. Even in the temple, they had split up.
I don't know.
They no longer knew where they all were.
I don't know. I just don't hear it. But someone wrote in the chat that being righteous doesn't mean that they had the Torah. That's true to a point. Meaning, I certainly believe in the idea that people can be moral human beings outside of Judaism. And this is a big discussion. We've actually had classes on the topic. But when you go back to what we read in the beginning, that he followed all the ways of his ancestor David, that's beyond just being righteous. That really suggests to me a knowledge of Judaism. So let me offer you the last explanation, which to me is the most compelling. Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, puts this idea out there. It's also recorded in source number 7 in Mitzudat David. The Malbim brings the idea. Rabbi Albo quotes this idea. It makes a lot of sense. The Torah records two different sections that are known as the Tochacha. Tochacha meaning education, but stronger than that. Tochacha is really a rebuke, a scolding. It's a set of verses in which God says to the Jews, if you build a society that follows my commands, everything's going to be great. Your farms will grow well, your animals will grow well, your families will grow well, everything will be wonderful and blessed. On the other hand, if you don't follow my commandments, you're going to get kicked out of the land and all sorts of horrible things are going to happen to you. This appears once at the end of the book of Leviticus when the Jews are on the cusp of entering the land of Israel. And then you have the incident with the spies and then they have to stay in the desert for 40 years. And then it appears a second time in the Torah portion of Ki Tavo, which is in Deuteronomy, when they're once again on the cusp of entering the land of Israel. And this section of rebuke, Deuteronomy chapter 28, is what Rabbi Altshuler in source number 7 says they found. It wasn't just that they found a Torah. They found a Torah that was rolled to the warning of what's going to happen to them in the event that they sin. I brought you Rabbi Levi ben Gershon in source number 10. Perhaps he saw the rebukes and that which continues from them in Deuteronomy. For there is hinted the exile of Samaria and the exile of Judea with the king of Judea. That is what he saw, and that was what freaked him out. That was what made him say, we're in trouble. If you go back to source number 5 for a second, you'll see support for this idea. In Huldah's words, where it says in source number 5, she responded. You see that? She responded, thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, say to the man who sent you to me, thus said the Lord, I am going to bring disaster upon this place and its inhabitants in accordance with all the words of the scroll which the king of Judah has read. So he read something that said that trouble is coming. So what was it? This warning. This is also going to fit really, really well with a passage from the Talmud that we're going to see a little bit later. But that's our third explanation. So we have three ideas. It was a Torah scroll that was shocking because he didn't have Torah scrolls. It was the Torah that Moses wrote, or it was this warning of punishment, and that inspired fear. I should note, some of the commentaries say that Moses' scroll was normally rolled to the beginning. So it was unusual to see it rolled to the punishments. That was part of the shock. Whatever it was, this discovery of the scroll turbocharges the reforms. Take a look at source number 11, please, and look at what happens here. First of all, a public teaching of the Torah. For anyone who's read the book of Ezra, this will sound very familiar because Ezra did something like this. The king went up to the house of the Lord. This is from Kings 2, chapter 23. There's a parallel passage in Chronicles 2, chapter 34. The king went up to the house of the Lord together with all the men of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the priests and prophets, all the people, young and old. And he read to them the entire text of the covenant scroll which had been found in the house of the Lord. A big public reading of this scroll. And then he continues. New covenant for the people with God. The king stood by the pillar and solemnized the covenant before the Lord that they would follow the Lord and observe his commandments, his injunctions, and his laws with all their heart and soul, that they would fulfill all the terms of this covenant as inscribed upon the scroll, and all the people entered into the covenant. So, a new commitment to follow God. And then he goes on a mega campaign, and I skipped some of the text, because it's a long text. But he goes on a mega campaign to eliminate idolatry. You'll remember that we already saw a discussion about him trying to eliminate idolatry. Look at this. Then the king ordered the high priest Chilkiah, had the priests of the second rank, the guards of the threshold, to bring out of the temple of the Lord all the objects made for Baal and Asherah, a tree worship, and all the hosts of heaven. He burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron, and he removed the ashes to Bethel. Then you get this very interesting story stuck in along the way. Do you remember last time when I introduced Josiah, I told you that way back in the time of King Rehoboam and Yerubbaal and the split of the kingdoms, when Yerubbaal in the north strays from following God, an anonymous prophet comes to him and says to him, a son is going to be born to the house of David. His name is going to be Josiah, and he's going to lead a reform. So take a look now at this passage here that we're up to in source number 11, where it starts, Josiah turned and saw the graves. He asked, what is the marker I see there? And the men of the town replied, that is the grave of the man of God who came from Judah and foretold these things that you have done to the altar of Bethel. Let him be, he said. Let no one disturb his bones. So they left his bones undisturbed together with the bones of the prophet who came from Samaria, .. So that the story comes full circle. He was predicted by this man, and now he protects his grave. More than that, the text continues that he sets up priests. Actually, if you jump from where we are right now in source number 11, if you can jump down to source number 12 first, because this tells you a little bit that the first text doesn't. We're working with both books. Chronicles 2, chapter 35. It's really nice that they have the JPS edition online and I didn't have to translate all this myself. He reinstated the priests in their shifts and rallied them to the service of the house of the Lord. He said to the Levites, consecrated to the Lord who taught all Israel, put the holy ark in the house that Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, built. As you no longer carry it on your shoulders, see now to the service of the Lord your God and his people Israel. Dispose yourselves by clans according to your divisions as prescribed in the writing of King David of Israel and in the document of his son Solomon. Attend in the sanctuary by clan divisions on your kinsmen, the people, by clan divisions of the Levites. What he's saying, in many words, is that they always had shifts of Levites and priests to work in the temple. Each shift had their own week. That's described much earlier in Tanakh, going back to the time of David. So he reinstates the shifts that they had, but there was something else stuck in there in the middle that I want to come back to. So don't forget what we just read here. I just wanted to take you back first to source number 11, the end of source number 11, where it says the king commanded all the people. The king commanded all the people, offer the Passover sacrifice to the Lord your God as prescribed in the scroll of the covenant. Now the Passover sacrifice had not been offered in that manner in the days of the chieftains who ruled Israel, that means the shoftim, the judges, or during the days of the kings of Israel, the kings of Judah. Only in the 18th year of King Josiah was such a Passover sacrifice offered in that manner to the Lord in Jerusalem. He makes a Passover sacrifice like has not been seen in a very, very long time. So he is running with it. He's going to make everything new. He's going to make everything better. But he knows what he's up against, and he also prepares for the worst. If you take a look at, where did I bring it? Yes, take a look at the end of source number 11. After it talks about him getting rid of the necromancers and the mediums, there was no king like him before who turned back to the Lord with all his heart and soul and might in full accord with the teaching of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. However, the Lord did not turn away from his awesome wrath, which had blazed up against Judah because of all of the things Menasseh did to vex him. God says it's not enough. And the reason why God says it's not enough is because he doesn't get everybody on board. And he knows it. And so he does something very interesting. Go back now to number 12, please. Did you notice what was in there besides the business about dividing up the priests and the Levites into shifts? What else was there? What else happened there besides the shifts in source number 12?
He says to put the holy ark back in a house.
Yeah. What does that line mean? Where has it been?
Well, it's obviously been not there, and it's been hidden, maybe. Perhaps it was hidden somewhere.
I don't understand. What does that even mean? And the business about not carrying it on their shoulders, they haven't carried it on their shoulders in 400 years. You no longer carry it on your shoulders. What in the world is he talking about? We know nothing about this. It's bizarre. And the Talmud says, the answer is that Josiah knows that Indiana Jones is coming. Josiah says, we're putting the ark away. When he says, put it in that house, you no longer carry it on your shoulders. What he's saying is, bury it. Take a look at source number 13. Passage in the Talmud. When the ark was put away, with it were put away the jar of manna, because the Torah said, God told Moses to take a jar of the manna and keep it as testimony for future generations in the Mishkan, in the temple, in the tabernacle the Jews had built. The jug of anointing oil, which they also kept there. Aaron's staff and its almonds and flowers, from that story with the revolt by Korach. The box the Philistines sent as a gift to the God of Israel. In the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel, chapter 5, it describes how the Philistines had taken the ark in war, and they sent it back with this gold box, and the Jews kept that box beside the ark. He buries all of these things. Who put it away? Yoshiahu, Josiah, put it away. What did he see to lead him to put it away? The answer is a verse in that tochacha, a verse in that section of rebuke. He saw Deuteronomy chapter 28, sentence 36, God will lead you and the king you establish over yourself away. He stood and put it away, as recorded in the verse we just read in Chronicles, about how they're not going to carry it anymore. So it all is of a piece. It all fits together. What they found was a scroll that was rolled to warnings of punishment. Huldah said to him, this is all going to come true. The Jews are going to go into exile. Josiah sees that and says, we have to prepare. He launches a mega campaign to reform everybody and bring them back, but he also prepares for the worst and says, I know that this is not going to succeed, or it may not succeed. You follow? And indeed, he did not succeed in bringing them back. And that brings me to his tragic death. Take a look at source number 14, please. Here we get to my translations instead of the JPS. So, in his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, ascended against the king of Assyria upon the Euphrates. We've talked about Egypt before and the role that they played in the region. Everybody's afraid of the Egyptians. Well, the Egyptians want to go fight the Assyrians. They want to go through Israel to do it. Pharaoh Necho mobilizes his troops, and they have to go, if you know the geography, they have to go north and east, right through Israel. King Josiah went to greet him, not greet him in a handshake way, greet him in a go-away way with his army. And Necho killed him in Megiddo when he saw him. And his servants, Josiah's servants, drove him away dead from Megiddo and brought him to Jerusalem and buried him in his grave. If I just read the account in the book of Kings, it's a function of international politics, right? Egypt and Assyria are fighting, and Josiah gets stuck in the middle. That's the simple way to read the story. However, the account in Chronicles is quite different. Take a look at source number 15, please. In the 18th year of the reign of Josiah, Yoshiahu, this Pesach was performed that we talked about. After all of Josiah's preparations of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, ascended to fight in Carchemish on the Euphrates. He is looking to fight the Assyrians. And Josiah went to meet him. And Necho sent messengers to him, saying, "What is between me and you, king of Judea? It is not against you today, but to the place of my battle. And God has said to speed me along." He says, "I don't want to fight with you. I just want to go through your land." And God said, "Let me go. Leave God be who is with me, and he will not destroy you." Now, his God is not our God. He's, you know, Egyptian. But his point is, I am on a mission from my God, and you better get out of my way. But Josiah did not turn away from him, but he disguised himself to fight with him. This is something you see from time to time in Tanakh, where the king will pretend to be somebody else, so that they don't go to target him. He did not listen to the words of Necho from God, and he came to fight in Bikat Megiddo. And the archer shot at King Josiah, and the king told his servants, "Take me away, I am very ill." He's been punctured. And his servants transported him from the chariot, and they rode him on his second chariot, and they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died. He was buried in the graves of his ancestors. All Judea and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah, and Jeremiah wailed for Josiah, and all the male and female singers spoke in their wailings about Josiah until today. They made these wailings a law for Israel, and they recorded it in the Lamentations. So, a different story now, right? He took a fight he didn't need, number one. And it says he didn't listen to the words of Necho from God. You could read that as Necho said, "I'm speaking in the name of God." However, that's not the way that the rabbis have taken it. There's a passage that appears in the Talmud and expanded upon in the Midrash, if you take a look at source number 16. He did not listen to the words of Necho from God. Look at this. Jeremiah, the prophet, told Josiah, "Thus I have received from my master Isaiah, and I will confuse Egypt against Egypt." And that's a verse predicting that Egypt is going to go to war. God said Egypt is going to go to war. I'm leaving aside the whole business of confusing Egypt against Egypt, because I think we're already confused enough. But Josiah did not listen. Rather, he told him, "Moses, your master's master said, 'And the sword will not travel through your land.' When you are fulfilling the commandments of God, no sword will travel through your land. Now this wicked person's sword shall travel through my land and my borders." And he didn't know that his entire generation served idolatry. He didn't realize that he really had not succeeded. There's another part to this Midrash, which I actually thought I had brought on here, but I didn't, which describes how he actually acknowledges his mistake to Jeremiah, that Jeremiah comes to him and leans over and he hears him acknowledging his sin. And his acknowledgement of sin makes it into Lamentations chapter 4. What we do know is, as you saw at the end of source 15, Jeremiah wails for him, and indeed the eulogy and the wailing is the fourth chapter of the book of Lamentations. That is understood as being the chapter that is the eulogy for, the eulogy for Josiah. So that's his story. Obviously, there's a lot more to discuss, and we could spend a lot of time on him. We could do that in a miniseries just on him. I see your hand, Claudette, but I actually want to get through one key element here. And I see that even though I said we may not need an hour, apparently we do. So I'm going to go through this here. Josiah, Yoshiyahu, is a true scion of the house of David, as emphasized in the text itself. First of all, as we read last time, I brought it for you again here in source number 17, he was predicted, "A son shall be born to the house of David." That identity is there from the start. He comes into a world which has abandoned the path of David. If you take a look at source number 18, this is describing Josiah's grandfather, Manasseh. Manasseh placed the statue of Asherah he had made in the house of which God had said to David and his son Solomon, in this house and in Jerusalem I have chosen, I shall place my name forever. David had understood that God was going to be there. Manasseh took God out of it and put his idol into it. That's the world that Josiah enters. And he is described as following in the ways of David. I brought you the verse in source number 19. He did what was pleasing to the Lord. He followed all the ways of his ancestor David. Unlike Rehoboam, right? Rehoboam wanted to exceed his ancestors. Rehoboam said, my father was this, I'm going to be this times two. So there. He wants to go in the ways of his ancestors. I brought you also from Chronicles 2. He did that which was just in... I did mute everybody, but I did not succeed. Okay. He did that which was just in the eyes of God. He went in the paths of his father David. He did not stray right or left. He began to seek the God of his father David. He is perpetually trying to emulate the ways of David. And he has a Torah scroll that has a key role in keeping him in line, unlike what happened with Solomon. Take a look at source number 21. This should look familiar. We've read this before. This is from the Torah's Laws of Kings. When he is seated on his royal throne, he shall have a copy of this teaching, the Torah, written for him on a scroll by the Levitical priests. Let it remain with him and let him read it all his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God, to observe faithfully every word of his teaching as well as these laws, dot, dot, dot. This is supposed to be what keeps him in line, and that's exactly what happens for Josiah. He is a follower of the ways of David and of what monarchy is supposed to be. And you see it in his specific actions. He's very focused on the temple, like David was. David very much wanted to build the temple. He put aside materials for it. He developed plans for it. He restored the shifts of the priests. You see it in source number 22, which were the shifts that were designated by David in the first place. He had a great national celebration of Passover. And we saw that in one text it said not they hadn't had that since the days of the judges. In the other text it says not since the days of Samuel and David. And Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, in source number 23, makes that point. He put away the ark in the house of David and Solomon. Josiah is the heir of the house of David. And one last note on this, in this context. Take a look at source number 24. You remember the passage we mentioned above about why he went to Huldah instead of to Jeremiah? Jeremiah was out of town bringing back the tribes. So take a look at source number 24. Rabbi Yochanan said, Jeremiah returned them. All those stories about the 10 lost tribes, they're not lost. They already came back way back when. They were back at the end of the first temple. Jeremiah returned them, and Josiah, son of Amon, reigned over them. How do we know that they returned? Because Ezekiel, they quote you a verse from Ezekiel, which, frankly, is a little bit elaborate for us to go through right now, but I'll explain it outside of the text. There is a mitzvah of Yovel. Every 50 years, ancestral land goes back to its original holder. Any slaves who chose to remain as slaves during the sabbatical year are automatically freed during this Jubilee year, during this Yovel year. And Ezekiel says that in the future, that Jubilee year, when the Jews go into exile with the destruction of the first temple, the Jubilee is going to be halted. The problem is that if you already lost your 10 tribes, the Jubilee would already have been halted, because the Jubilee is only observed when all the Jews are in their land, or the majority of Jews, perhaps, are in their land. So he says they've had a Jubilee year. So it must be that the tribes came back. And then they go further to try to demonstrate that to you. I'm rushing a little bit. I hope this will be somewhat clear. In the second paragraph, in source number 24, they point out that story in which Josiah found the grave of the prophet who had predicted his birth. That grave was in Beth-El. Beth-El was in the northern kingdom. Says the Talmud, what was Josiah doing in the northern kingdom? If the 10 tribes had already been exiled, why was he there? The answer is because the 10 tribes came back. He had already brought them back from exile. And there's another verse from Hosea, that's brought as proof there. But I think one of the greatest proofs is source number 25, a verse in Isaiah chapter 18, in which there is a prediction that the Assyrians are going to bring back a treasure to the Lord of hosts, a tribute to the Lord of hosts. In the context, they're talking about those 10 tribes that the Assyrians had exiled. The Assyrians bring them back. So there are no lost tribes. My apologies to all the people who think they're lost tribes. They're not lost tribes. They may be something else. That doesn't mean they're not Jewish, but they're not lost tribes, according to this. So that's the story of Josiah, the true heir of the house of David. But I want to conclude on an upbeat note, because right now it sounds like it ends in tragedy, which it does. I mean, he dies, and painfully so. Nonetheless, I noted something in a class on Tisha B'Av years ago, and I gave you a link for it in source number 26. Even when we hit rock bottom, we still have hope because we know that a better day is coming. Because it's true that Josiah failed. But remember also that he came out of nowhere. He came into this after 55 years of Menashe, of the wicked King Amon, who was killed in a coup. He was assassinated, right? And no one saw it coming that now you were going to get a great and righteous king. You had 31 years of glory. Not that everybody bought into it. They didn't all buy into it. We saw that. But nonetheless, you had 31 great years. And so lightning can strike twice. The fact that you had a Josiah means there can be another one. And to me, he should be held up as a symbol of hope for what can be achieved when we do commit ourselves to the legacy of the house of David. That's what I see. Okay, Claudette.
How old was Josiah when he died?
So we know that he reigned for 31 years, and we know that he was 8 when he started, so 39. An important number for those who have not yet signed up for the numerology series. We're going to talk about lucky numbers, we're going to talk matria, we're going to talk about all sorts of stuff. And a fantastic story from the time of the Japanese earthquake. So it's going to be interesting. Yes, Sarah.
Hi, Bob. You mentioned their lamentations, both men and women. In those times, women would lament.
So they had a practice. So they had a practice of hiring professional mourners. They were called mekonenot. And the women would come to the cemetery, it seems. Maybe they were at the Sheva house. Maybe they were out in the road. I don't know exactly. But they would wail and cry. And the goal was for them to get everybody else into a frame of mind of wailing and crying. So the answer, in short, is yes.
The Christians have taken it over because in very remote parts of Romania, it's still the custom to do that.
Interesting. I mean, I would dare say it's not something that like is all that creative for us to come up with. Like, I'm sure that societies, it didn't mean that they took that from us. Maybe they did. But it was certainly something back in the day. Jeremiah talks about it when he predicts the destruction of the temple. He says, call for the mekonenot, these women who wail. So you did have that. Yeah, Rosalind, you're muted.
Source number 12,
yeah.
When he instructs the Levites to put the holy ark in the house of Solomon, to put that away.
Yeah.
But then it says, see now to the service of the Lord your God. Well, they put the Torah scrolls away. So what are they using in order to teach everybody the word of God?
Right. I made that more clear. I apologize. The ark specifically has the tablets in it. The Torah scrolls they still have. They're not burying those. They're putting away the ark that has the original tablets.
What do you mean, the Ten Commandments? Those tablets?
Those tablets. Correct. That's okay. What they're putting away. Yeah.
The broken ones and the whole ones.
Right. So the broken and the whole ones are both stored in arks. The question of is it one ark or two arks is a great discussion separately. But yes, that's what they're putting away here. They don't want it to be taken when they go into exile. So they bury it on the spot instead.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. Okay, everyone. I'm looking forward to next week and Jewish numerology. If you haven't yet signed up, you still can. I'm going to be sending out an email promoting it. You will get it even if you already signed up. Don't worry. Registered. I have your registration. Thank you very much, and looking forward. And Chanukah Sameach. Thank you. Chanukah.